This is an interview with Helen Sanders in her home in Costa Mesa. The date is October 24th, 1976. Sandy, I think the first question I want to ask is a simple one. It's just, when and how did you first become involved with the Daughters of Bilitis? How did you hear about it?
Dale Martin and Phyllis Lyon happened to be two of my very close friends in those days, and they were essentially the founders of the Daughters. And so they came to me and said, "You must help us. You must join." And I said, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" And they said, "Well, we don't know, but whatever it is, we're going to do it," because they had gotten... The reason they started was that they found that about the only place that they could contact anyone would be in a bar, and mostly they were men's bars, a mixture. And they felt that there needed to be some kind of a social get-together arrangement, probably in people's homes and stuff. So originally that's what it was. And Phyllis put out the first letter, which was one mimeographed sheet. Pretty bad, too. And being the type of people all of us were, it didn't take it very long to get to be slightly political. It wasn't social very long.
But at the time they first spoke to you, it was largely, it was thought of still as a social club?
Well, there were only seven people involved in it at that time. I think I was the seventh. And then two of those girls moved to Reading, so... as we went on, we already knew each other, so we didn't really need the social club. So we began to recruit people that had other reasons for being in it. I might add that we very early on discovered that the only thing we had in common with each other was the fact that we were lesbians. We had everything in there from what might today be considered John Birchers right down to what were then called bleeding heart liberals.
Uh-huh.
So we couldn't talk about too many other things.
So how did it make the shift from being a social group to one that became more overtly political?
They had a party one night at a place called Kelly's Bar, which is down, I believe it's in San Mateo County, I'm not sure. But at any rate, it's south of San Francisco somewhere. And a lot of young people, gay gals, were there. And it was a semi-private arrangement, I think. I wasn't there. But the cops busted it, and they brought everybody in and charged them with frequenting a place of ill repute. However, they didn't say that. They just quoted them the number of the law, the ordinance. And everybody pleaded guilty to it, except two little gals who had just made 21, and they didn't feel they were guilty of anything. And it was our determination that the reason these girls pleaded guilty to whatever it was, not even knowing, was that they felt guilt about being gay and being out having some fun in a situation like that. And we analyzed the total guilelessness of these two youngsters who weren't guilty of anything in their own eyes. And we said, well, you know, we're the only people that are even together. We do have a charter. We are a club. So we retained a lawyer and began to work on that level, and two levels. One was to protect the legal rights of the individual, and the other one was to begin to strengthen the self-image of the individual. And that's really what sparked it.
What motivated you, I mean, 20 years ago when it was it was difficult to be a lesbian at that time.
Indeed.
To actually be involved in an organization.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what kept you going?
Oh, well, I think it's a personality thing. Both Dale and Phil and I had always been fairly politically motivated anyway. I'd been involved in newspapers and publishing and the Democratic Party in Oregon and a lot of things like that. And I just suppose that, well, we were very strongly motivated by civil rights in almost every area. It wasn't just that, but this was our world. This was, we were making out. We all had jobs we had a social life. We owned homes. We were all right. But we realized that there were an awful lot of people just hanging out in these bars and so on. They weren't having much fun, and they were pretty nice people mostly when you got to know them. And we were just that kind of people that do those things. They're the same kind of people that get involved in almost any movement. And in our case, since we were lesbian and fairly happy within our role and our place, we didn't feel comfortable there without being useful.
At the time that you became involved with DOB, did you still have much contact with the bar culture, or was your life pretty much separate from that?
Oh, well, no, I knew. Our favorite place used to be the Paper Doll up in San Francisco, which was very good in those days. It was a good restaurant, had good, very good image around the area. San Francisco's always been a little different from other places, I think. We went out on weekends to bars, but we had groups of people that we particularly knew. It was the kind of thing where you always find a few where you work, mm-hmm. and you meet a few of their friends. And there was a big group, but we did. We entertained sometimes in our home and sometimes in the bar if we were there.
How did recruitment for DOB work? I mean, did you just sort of like drag your friends to meetings and force them to stay, or did you know most of the people who got involved?
Yeah, we did. And then, of course, a lot of it came right through the bars. People that did go there, they knew other people, and they would be glad to tell us if somebody was in trouble. And so we began having meetings in a chiropractor's office down in San Francisco. And we had this big mass meeting about the Kelly's Bar, and I think about 25 people came to that. All the people that had been there, for one, and some of their friends and acquaintances.
Was that larger than most of the meetings?
Oh, yeah.
Were?
Yeah. We had quite small meetings most of the time in the early days. And of course, we were very fussy. Everybody had to dress up and look nice. And, you know, shit, they hadn't even invented the pantsuit. it was tough.
Why was there so much emphasis in the early days on standards of dress and behavior?
Well, probably because those of us who did have jobs were pretty much kind of carrying burden, and we could all lose our jobs, particularly people in civil service jobs or public jobs. That has not ceased even when this later wave So the idea of if you were going to have 25 people marching into a downtown public office building, you didn't want them to all look stereotyped, so that you also had three or four cops coming straight along behind them, which did happen sometimes.
Uh-huh.
We've frequently, in the early days, had a cop in the back there.
Where did you hold the public discussion meetings?
At first, they were held at this chiropractor's office. Some of them were held at the same area that the Mattachine Society did, which was the Quaker Society of Friends meeting place up there. And some of them were held in the old building on 4th Street, where 6th Street, where the Mattachine office were. And then after a while, as we got a few more people and a few more of them had jobs, we hiked up some dues and rented space from time to time. We had several different places that we had offices that were added for that.
How did you cope in those early days with the fear that most of the women must have had of police or of being discovered or anything like that?
Oh, we used to give them hell. We used to say, "What do you mean you think you'll lose your job as a school teacher if you come to a respectable meeting like this when I saw you with my very eyes dancing at the beige room last night with a woman?" I mean, we were very hostile about this. We said, you go down there in fear and trembling and get blind drunk in order to satisfy the fears that you got, but when you could come to this and be perfectly respectable and maybe do something about it. And gradually we did overcome a lot of people's fears, and as they came, they realized that we We didn't have orgies. We didn't deal in any kind of sexual permissiveness of any kind. We actually did business meetings and discussed things and had speakers from the various professions that, as I say, the purpose was to be self-enhancing, to begin to build this image.
What did you discuss at the business meetings in those early days? I mean, it strikes me that there probably wasn't too much business for...
Not a lot. We had... sometimes we'd have an attorney come and explain the laws to us so that if somebody read you a number, you knew what you were pleading to, what the potential was of ever changing them, how to operate in case of arrest, things like that. We had Dr. Baker was a psychiatrist who came and spoke. Much of it was aimed at understanding just what this was, because we found that a large majority of these girls just, they knew they were different, they knew what they did, but they had almost no understanding of what, psychological or physical factors that might have had any bearing on it, and they were simply lost and very lonely. What they needed to know, what we figured they needed to know, was everything we could possibly find out.
It's one of the things that surprised me about this is, and I guess this is part of the generation gap in reading like early issues of the latter, is that very often there were speakers invited who really didn't have particularly good things to say.
True.
About lesbians. Mm-hmm. I mean, why did you invite people like that?
You've got to know who the enemy is. the most dangerous thing there is a fear. And fear is almost based on what you don't know. For example, I always would say, you had a problem. Say, some guy's going to walk into a lion's den. Well, if he's a lion tamer, he knows what he's going to do. But I'm not going in there, because I don't know what I'm going to be up against. I don't know how to cope with it. And it would be foolhardy to not to know. Either to know enough not to go in or to know what you did after you got in.
Mm-hmm.
And our whole idea was based on knowledge. Now, we didn't feel, now what happened a lot of the time, although sometimes they got one by accident, but what the men were doing was trying, they'd get these speakers, it was just, you know, being very beneficial and build them up I'd get really horrified if they got some fellow in there like the monkey gland guy that was going to change all our organs around for them in state prison. We had him with lunch, too. But our feeling was that you got to know the enemy. You want to know exactly how these people feel. If you don't know how they feel, how are you going to approach them? How are you going to be able to... For instance, if we hadn't early on gotten deeply into finding out how various churches felt about us, how religions were, we wouldn't have known then how to do certain publicity, how to set up certain programs. There's no sense in sitting around having people's patch on the head. We could do that to each other or anyplace else. But if you get a lawyer that's going to come in there and tell you that this, he's or a judge that tells you exactly what he's going to do to you, okay, then you know what your enemy is, you know how what your plan is going to have to be. You may not know exactly how to go about it, but at least you know that out over here is an ogre that's not going to let this nice person do too much for you.
And if they have any power, we could come out with
yeah.
Cross-examination
sure.
At the meeting.
We needed
what
to learn.
What they thought was one thing, but what could they do about it?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We had a convention in San Francisco in which we invited the head of the Alcoholic Beverage Commission. Well, we bugged that guy until he finally blew up, and he was talking about closing down bars and arresting people for dancing with the same sex in a public place. And, of course, in California, that is the prerogative of the California Beverage Commission. They give the licenses. And he kept on quoting law and doing everything else, but none of it, and there is no law that absolutely states this, and so finally we got him to mad enough that when somebody asked the question one more time, by whose opinion, by whose authority,
he was offended.
who is offended by this? And he said, I am offended.
Oh,
and the whole place just broke up because that's what we wanted. We wanted to know, do we fight you or do we fight the Alcoholic Beverage Commission? Do we protect the bar owner or did the bar owner protect us? We needed all that information, but all we were getting was his filter defense.
Would you say there was a difference then in the approach that the daughters were taking towards people like this from the approach that the Mattachine was taking in its conventions?
Oh, I think that the daughters were much more bold about it from the beginning. I think the daughters, actually I think the men agreed to that, but their argument was that lesbians weren't harassed like gay boys and that they could take the chances, and they were afraid of us, really, because we'd tackle anything.
We had some inter-office communication. I think Don Slater came down off. He was just terrified. He was so mad he was foaming. And he wrote this wild thing to Bill, and he was probably president at the time. She was. And she wrote him, shot him back on and said, well, Don, I think that if you come and dress properly, no one will mistake you for a lesbian.
You see, we took on a Jack Tar Hotel in San Francisco, and we invited anybody that wanted to, and we did it right out. We had the lobby bar, the bar set up in the lobby, and there were architects' conventions and everything else going on there. And Stella and I, and at that time Dylan Phil, belonged to an organization called the Prosperos, which is a metaphysical group. And we invited a whole bunch of their people. We also did in Los Angeles. We invited all kinds of straight people. We invited panels that would represent different ideas so that there would be discussion and so on. And we did frighten the men because they seem to, again, in this organizational world as much as in any place else at that time, and probably some still, were male chauvinists. They felt that they had better jobs to lose, and they had better professions to lose, and they were harassed more, and their needs were greater, and all that sort of stuff. And so they played a little closer.
Until later.
Then, of course, it blew up.
What were the particular issues that were most important to members of DOB in the early years? I mean, what were the problems that the members faced that you had some hope of trying to solve or come to grips with?
Well, of course, our prime purpose from the very beginning was to negotiate some kind of change in law. But we knew that even if you had change in the law at that time, it would have made very little difference. Because I think that was amply proved in Illinois when they pioneered state changing the law, that the majority of the people didn't change their minds. And we knew that unless you termited from within in some way, that you got more friends, more people, more professional straight people, more research being done in universities, more publicity and so on, changing the law wasn't going to do much. But nonetheless, we went right along with Mattachine with one in the attempts to make change in the law. And we certainly supported one very heavily when they went to Supreme Court. We always did. We never separated ourselves from the men's groups in that sense. Where we began to separate from them, as Phyllis put it so coyly once, I always get to be secretary and I always make the coffee, just like down at work. and that was not our thing. We had, our problems were different, and it's very simple that our problems are different. The men would like us to join them. Well, we pointed out to them one day that we felt that it would be very unlikely that breast cancer would be a problem of theirs. We thought it would be very unlikely that an unwanted pregnancy would be a problem of theirs. There are many things that lesbians have to deal with that would be of no interest whatever to the men, and they weren't even aware of them. But among lesbians, this happens. You have the lesbian mother with the children and so on. You have a lot of problems that are indigenous only to women. And we felt that while we like to come together with men on the big legal issues, things of that nature, that on the personal level, women were much better off doing their own thing. I don't know that we ever convinced the men of that, but we tried.
What kind of a response did you get from, say, people in the Mattachine or some of the men in One when you tried to explain to them over and over again that we had some similar concerns but a lot of different concerns?
Well, they would point out to us that once One had a woman for president, they had their token female. I don't know. You know, they would give us very little. They didn't feel that our problems were that big. You know, I've gone to so many discussions of venereal disease at One in Mattachine that I know everything I need to know about how men do it and get it and what there ought to be done about it. And I've even given money to their committee, but I said, you know, fellas, that's not the way it works with us. What you're talking about isn't going to help us any. Well, it didn't matter, because I think to this very day, I really believe that the men think that they are one-tenth of the population and we're one-hundredth of it or something like that. I don't know. We had good friends. Certain people like Jim Kepner and so on, and Dorr, to some extent, waspish though he is. And Hal Call, certain people like that who were close friends with the leaders of the Daughters, and we enjoyed each other's company and we got along fine. It was as a group that it didn't seem. You see,
policy would just be attached.
Yeah, the policy, we couldn't make it. And it was pointed out to me one time by Dr. Baker, who seemed to know a lot, and I think Evelyn Hooker has said that a gay man, not every gay man, but a great many of the gay men that you found in those early organizations were totally terrified of women. They didn't... We were women. To hell with this lesbian crap. We were still women. And many of those people were gay men who did not like women. They didn't like their mothers, or they were in love with her, or something was wrong, but they, by God, they didn't like women. And especially, they certainly didn't like authoritarian women like Del, Phil, and so on. They would be frightened. It was like maybe Mama had come with a big stick again and was going to tell you what to do. Our problems are bigger than that. And I think psychologically that was very true. I think that is a problem. It was.
Okay. I think one place where it broke down for me was that the really important leaders between both the men and the women, it didn't matter. That wasn't one of their problems. And what they couldn't see, or at least what the men could see even less than the women, because this was one of our claims, was that, look, we have our women down here at an open meeting that are scared to death of men. And if they know men are going to be there, they won't come. Okay, we say, well, tough shit, girl, we only have this one open meeting, you can stay away. But I knew from the correspondence at One that there were men who felt just the same way, only worse. They were vile. You get those goddamn lesbians off your team, I'll send you some money. I said, Jesus, we should leave. Well, Dorr and Don said, no. I said, no, this is serious. These guys have a right to an organization that tends to their needs. If we terrify them that much, this is no damn good. Well, they were very dedicated and very sincere about this being cooperative. And
they
One,
tried.
One, I felt, was much more sincere and much more dedicated to making this thing work on a co-educational basis than the Mattachine. Because they did. They had women. If women could have taken hold and done the women's operation, the women's page, and, you know, had a woman editor once and all this stuff, if it could have worked, it would have worked with One, because they did try. But what they were ignoring were their own men who underneath would write these emails. What do you mean with a woman's page? Yeah. You know? And they were ignoring all of this pain going down on both levels. We could, I would say, well, look, let's cooperate at the top when we have the big meetings. You know, and the once a year stuff. And then let's let the little peons, or whatever you want to call them, you know, the laymen, the people clear down at the bottom, they're scared of them, they're out in photo. Let them think this is their own male organization or their own female organization, and why Congress graduated, we were dedicated to integrating on all levels, with society and with each other, and in any way possible, and not of shoving it down somebody's throat.
So there really was a difference then between the leadership of the organizations mm-hmm. and
oh, yes.
many of the members.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But the leaders didn't have the problems that the members did, and the leaders were trying to help the members get out of those problems. At least on our side, they were. We felt we had to educate them to accept themselves. Well, you couldn't do that without actually getting your hands on them and talking to them personally. Whereas at one, where it was mostly by mail, the guy wasn't even going to come out of the woodwork.
That, of course, is important. One had by the magazine, which had been going quite a while, I guess, before the daughters came on, and Mattachine magazine and so on, had gotten around the country a good bit. And they had a lot of contacts in the early years with people that they'd never met, never did meet, I suppose. Whereas the daughters started in this one little ball right in San Francisco, and it only grew a little bit at a time out from that. And when it began to get very much bigger, it began to run into a lot of problems because, I don't know whether this is because women are like that, but we found that we couldn't hold it together when we had chapters in New York and Philadelphia and Chicago and various places. We could do very well in California. We did quite well between San Francisco and Los Angeles over some time. But we really seemed to need a personal contact. And I think perhaps that's one of the reasons that the latter was a lot more fiction and chatty and poetry and then serious articles, a rather broader type of magazine than one or Mattachine.
Can you talk a little bit about the kinds of problems that appeared once the daughters did begin to expand beyond its California base? Because there's an undercurrent that like ran through some of the issues of the latter, like at the point at which Barbara Giddings was editor, that there really was a different perspectives from the East Coast and the West Coast, but it never becomes clear as to what the differences were.
Well, they're clear to me. You're speaking of three or four of the worst years of my life.
which years are those now? This would be the early 60s?
What are they, Stella? I took the latter on when we lived in Lawndale.
You became editor of the latter in 1966, or at least that's when your name starts.
That's right. I had been the production manager of it for some time before that, however. Dell and Phil alternated somewhat. I think I had been putting it together and getting it printed and one thing another pretty much all the way along. I was for a year in San Francisco before I moved here, and I was also president of the chapter up there. But after I moved to Southern California, I continued to do the latter, but Dell and Phil alternated or worked together on as editor. Then I became editor of it, and I was editor of it for a long time until actually, I think about its last year and a half, wasn't it? And then I shoved it over to Barbara Giddings because she was becoming so cantankerous that Jean Damon.
Not Barbara Giddings.
Barbara Greer, yeah, Jean Damon. Barbara Greer was what I term, among certain lesbians, a man-hater. And somewhere along in there, we began to have this schism in the organization that was pretty much down the line of, well, which ultimately began. Giddings didn't have much to do with the latter.
Well,
she was editor of it for a while, but she simply sent the stuff to me, and I used what I could of it and put it together. Barbara Giddings
uh-huh.
was never difficult to work with. She was, I think the only reason she and I got into a tangle was because she began to politicize it considerably more than I wanted it to be. She got involved with these big court cases back east, and she got terribly involved with Frank Kameny and that whole very militant gay group.
Mm-hmm.
They were taking everything to the Supreme Court, marching and carrying on, and I said to her at the time that I didn't believe that the National Magazine, which went to many, many people who in West Overshoe, Nebraska, simply wanted something that made them happy once a month, that was something that was theirs, that they really didn't want to get into that, and that if we were going to do that type of thing, it should be done by the Eastern chapters, and it should be separate, because I found from the letters that I got that came to me, generally, that our average readership was not interested at all in big issues. They simply wanted nice poetry and good articles, and they liked to read about successful lesbians, and they liked to have nice pictures, and then they could put up with some good editorial material. Well, the original blow-up, it began. It was supposed to have been settled, but it wasn't. It was always there. One of the things that was basic to the Constitution of the Daughters of Bleeders is that we did not, as an organization, endorse, join, or do anything with any other organization. Now, that was meant to include the Republican Party, the ACLU, anything you care to name. In other words, we had only one purpose, and that was the one we were working with. And while we would use speakers, all sorts of things of that nature from any other organization, that we would not at any time become a part of another one. Well, we had a convention out here, and Barbara wanted us to join the New York Mattachine Society. And at that time, New York and San Francisco Mattachine were having a big scene. And we had a real, well, it was a fight. It was the kind of fight that you do nicely with Robert's rules, but it went on a long time. And
Was that the convention in San Francisco in 1960, mm-hmm. not the one in Los Angeles?
No, that was 1960 in San Francisco. It was the first big one.
And what was the issue then that was being raised?
Barbara and the Eastern group wanted the Daughters of Bleeders to merge with the New York Mattachine Society in the East. And we could, if we wanted to, merge with the New York with the San Francisco Mattachine. And we pointed out to her that that was strictly against the Constitution and bylaws of our organization. Well, she didn't see that. She felt that that only referred to political organizations or something of that nature. Well, we didn't. We had specifically put it in there for that very reason. And so the old Daughters prevailed on the matter, and it was settled, and we went on about our business. But I don't think Barbara ever took it too seriously, because she then went back to New York, and the New York chapter's offices were in the same office as the Mattachine Society. And then ultimately, this big whopping editorial that she published was pure Mattachine. And so at that point, Dell and Phil and the other officers, including myself, pulled the magazine from her editorship, and I took it over, and I kept it until I gave it to Barbara Greer in a moment of pure madness.
Why? Now, what kind of argument or rationale was Barbara Giddings using to try and convince, to make the case for merging with the Mattachine when a women's organization had been so important for DOB all along?
Barbara's attitudes were not ours. Barbara is a doer, a mover, a political animal. She wants to go to court. She wants to make things happen. And the Daughters of Bilitis was just really not her cup of tea anyway, and she just tried to move it so that it was. And we felt that if Mattachine, we said any individual could join anything they wanted to. So if she wanted to join Mattachine and work with them, that was her privilege, but she couldn't take the organization with her. We didn't care if she took the entire Daughters of Bilitis if they went on an individual membership basis, but did not carry with them the contracts and the bylaws and the Constitution and the charters in New York State and California with her. And I think ultimately that's pretty much what did happen. I think that Barbara began working so much with Frank Kameny that I don't think she was doing anything with the Daughters toward the end. They formed this thing called the West Side Discussion Group or something. It was a separate group, and they worked pretty heavily with that. And and so at that point, somewhere along in there came Shirley Willer. Shirley Willer had some funds to disseminate, and she was on the side of the Daughters at that point. And she put up some money to enlarge the ladder, and when I came to take the ladder over, I had pretty good working capital, and I got it printed, and that's the point at which it began to be quite a nice-looking magazine. I began to get it printed commercially, and so I just ran it the way I wanted to from then on. Dell and Phil would send me articles and so on that needed to be, they wanted in there, and I'd put them in, and I got good material around the country. And at that time, Gene Damon, who had been working for One, began to submit all of her book reviews and articles on great lesbians and so on to us. And we had a pretty good little rag for a while. It wasn't great, but by any journalistic standards, I suppose, but for the type of thing we were doing, it was all right. And we got good readership, and we got a lot of fine letters from people out in the small towns, the lonely people. That's what we were really going for. We felt from the beginning that we could always handle on an organizational level the people that needed our attention in the big cities and people with legal problems on. What the ladder was for, primarily, was a sort of a sounding board, but it was mostly an entertainment factor. You see, up until the late 60s, the literature, lesbian literature, was limited, except in the classics and a few Reeker paperbacks and so on. There wasn't all that stuff, and a lot of that crap was written by guys that just write potboilers, and they change the names, put in a few sex acts, and that's a big thing. And so we were able to seek out some good writers and get them to write some short stories for us and so on, to push their books. And if necessary, we sold the books. Like if somebody was out in West Overshoe, Nebraska, we could send them one in a brown paper wrapper. They couldn't get it at the local drugstore, you know.
So the latter really wasn't meant to be kind of a political journal for a political organization.
No, it never was.
It had a different purpose.
That's right. We felt that our political action should be done by an organizational level by the groups in active participation, open meetings, conventions, lectures, picketing, whatever they want to do. That's where that should come. But the ladder was supposed to be for all members, all subscribers. Well, subscribers, not even members. I mean, they didn't have to be a member to get the magazine. We didn't want to mix those two things together. Because, as I said, when we started out, we found early on that the only thing these people had in common was the fact that they were lesbians. And the depths of their fears and the depths of their political ideas and so on, things like that, were extraneous. Only at the organizational level did that stuff ever arise. And Barbara, being Barbara, and I love Barbara, but man, she'd drive you crazy. She'd come to these meetings and say overnight, you'd give her a sleeping bag, and you'd be up until 2 o'clock in the morning, and shit, 5 o'clock, there she is, up doing her push-ups and her exercises, you know, ready charged down the road here. Anybody got a bicycle? What are we going to do today? You just can't hold anybody like that down. Her idea, why she She couldn't sit still for a two-hour business meeting in which you discussed the possibilities of having a booth at the county fair. Her idea was you went up and tore down the gates. To hell with that stuff. Well, you see, we were too tame for Barbara. And I think it's very good that she found this group of people, mostly headed, I suppose, by Frank in the early days, that she could work with, because we couldn't use her energy. And somebody could, and I'm sure that Barbara has been a very violent and moving force on the scene in the East and other places too. So that was fine with me, as long as she didn't contaminate the ladder with it, because I could just see some of our little waifs out here in the country just quaking in their boots and figuring that tomorrow morning somebody would track down where they got this filthy magazine that was threatening to take over the New York police force or something.
If to go back a little bit in time to the beginnings of the ladder, why did such an organization that at that time was still so small make the decision to embark upon a project which really takes up a lot of time, is publishing a magazine?
Why, because Phyllis Lyon was the first woman editor of the Daily Californian, I want you to know, and I was from the newspaper background, and our whole life is publishing.
Uh-huh.
We wouldn't, you know, you don't do anything without letting people have a communication on the matter. That's perfectly simple. That's just the personality of the founders.
So in a sense, it was a stroke of luck that it should have been the two of you
right.
Who were very much involved.
And Dell also Dell is a marvelous writer. She's a better writer than Phyllis. I think her book, Lesbian Women, Dell did most of the writing on that. Phyllis did a lot of the technical put together, because Phyllis is a journalism major. She knows a lot about that, and she was. Daily Cal is one of the most important campus newspapers in the United States, and of course during the war, Phyllis made it because there weren't any guys. And I was a printer and had been a publisher. So you get three people like that sitting around a table, and the first thing they're going to do is put out a magazine, no matter how much effort it takes or what it's going to cost. You know, that's just has nothing to do with lesbian or anything else. It's just that three people aren't going to do what we were doing without publishing. But we wrote it early on into the agreement that the ladder would not be a political arm of the thing at all in any way. It was to be an informative, person-enhancing publication that no girl would be ashamed to have. Now, Barbara Giddings, I believe, is the one who, was it she or Greer that insisted on putting lesbian on the cover? Greer. Yeah. Giddings never did that. When Greer got hold of it, she decided she had to put it on there in large letters. But by that time, things were a lot different than when we started. I think the first few issues don't even mention it. They say education of the variant or something like that.
Right. Why did you use words like that?
I mean, we would never have gotten a charter in the state of California to do business if we'd used the proper term.
Uh-huh.
That's why we picked the name Daughters of Bilitis. We figured nobody in Sacramento knew who that was. And they didn't. I don't think they still do. Some in the Corporations Commission. But we did incorporate, and we... My real name is on the charter up in Sacramento, and that thing is so carefully worded that Sacramento never hesitated for a minute and just handed it right over to us. And yet it is written in such a way that there could be no doubt to high court as to what the intention was. We worked very hard on that.
Did you have legal advice in all this, mm-hmm. or did you do it mostly on your own?
No, we had a lawyer. His name is Ken Swearin. It's Zwerin. Yeah.
Uh-huh. How many people were in those, still in the 50s, how many people were the ones who were really the core of the organization, doing the work and keeping it going and publishing the ladder, reaching new members?
In the 50s and early 60s, about 10.
What kept you going through those years? I mean, with so few who were authentically committed?
Ha. Well, we put our own money into it. We, took up collections when we had meetings. I don't know if we could do it now. Inflation has set in. But in those days, you could rent a hall for $10. The ladder originally cost us, especially when I was printing it on Macy's equipment, cost us only the paper. I bought an old typewriter for $30 from somebody else that I'd worked for at one time. I used to have that in my apartment in San Francisco. And it didn't cost a lot, maybe $75 to $80 an issue. And we just put our own money into it. That's how it was done. Stella can tell you that. In the old days, it was the leadership. They worked and they made it. And some of us had jobs and contributed, and sometimes we'd find some scared soul someplace that had a lot of money that was willing to give us some, if we didn't mention their name. Later on, Shirley Willer became quite a fundraiser for us. She was from New York, Shirley and Marion Glass. They got a lot of money for it. That's where I finally got to where I could actually have the thing published. $1,000 a month, yeah. Mm. We never made money with the ladder. Never made money. It was always an expense. But we felt that it was a very necessary expense because, there again, now that happens to be the opinion of people that are publishers and editor type people who think that, well, that's the priority is greater on that, which you do. Was it Dr. Hayakawa? Somebody, no, he didn't say that. Somebody else said on all these political speeches. Oh, it was Reverend, what's his name, from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, talking to the black people, and Desi Jackson, he said, it's not that you can't learn or anything like that, but you always do best what you do the most. And he said, if all you do is dribble a basketball and twist your ass, that's what you do the best. So I'd say that if you get a core of people involved in a situation like that, and what they do the most is publishing and printing and so on, that's what your major expense is going to be. Now, this is not to say that what we did in the ladder, and I think if you read most of the copies of it through the years, you would discover that we did, in a subtle way, do a great deal. But we were never the axe-swinging type. We were not politically active in the ladder. We would report on anything that was valid. We would give tremendous coverage to conventions, including Mattachines or ones. We would give considerable space to interesting panels. Oh, sure. We did the reporting. One, and Mattachine never gave the in-depth reporting to their functions that we did. So, as a matter of fact, there, to that extent, we did do this. But you see, that also was enhancing to the image. We felt that that type of thing was very beneficial to the lonely person somewhere else. That was, we didn't feel that that was any threat. What was a threat was the thing wasn't all that bad. We admired Barbara. We liked her. Where the threat began was later on, when I had just about gone to my bed doing both the editorship and the publication of the thing, and I had a very responsible job at the time, and I would be up hours of the night, never going to bed, putting this thing out, and it was just getting too heavy. So finally we said that Barbara Greer, Gene Damon, could be the editor, but I would continue to be the production end of it. Well, it didn't take her long to let this attitude come in, which was the early beginnings of the women's movement, which was a militant, man-hating thing. Well, now that was never in our minds. None of the founders of the Daughters ever felt that way. Some of our best friends were men, and some of them were even straight. And we just really, now I think Del and Phil got so deeply involved in NOW and in various women's radical organizations that they've drifted off from that. But to my way of thinking, and Stella's certainly, to this very day, we do not hate men. We have no feeling that you can divide these people up like that and say these people are rotten, these are great, and this should all happen. So Barbara Greer and I began to have problems. And as they developed more and more, the real thing, she began to get her camp, and Del and Phil and I were still hanging on to ours, and Secretary Willer. And finally, I guess, the then president of the Daughters secured the mailing list and they eloped off to Reno or someplace.
That was Rita LaPorte.
Rita LaPorte, yeah. And it didn't take the ladder long to fold. Because.
No. Barbara still wasn't. No, she had about a year or so.
She ran it for
until 72, and then it.
But it didn't come out monthly. It was.
It started coming out every 2 months, yeah.
Well, that was crashing down from about 69 on. They ran with it before the 70 convention.
Yeah.
So she knew she wouldn't stand in a Democratic election.
No, she wouldn't. She wouldn't take a chance on it. So they just took it, and we didn't pursue it. We could have gotten it back. We could have gone through a lot of legal machinations about it. But Dell and Phil and I and we said, you know, that's over. You have to recognize that a certain time comes when that's over. We didn't want to do the political thing with that magazine or with the Daughters. By that time, there were organizations that were springing up that for those kind of people, they could go over and join now. And I understand Lesbian practically took that over eventually. Well, that's fine. Then go with that. I think it's a shame, but...
Christ, that's really supposed to be for housewives first. I thought.
Well...
It would be nice if they let us help them, but I don't think we could take them over. I think that's bad news.
I somehow never progressed to the consciousness-raising, militant feminism thing. That's just never been my cup of tea, and it wasn't for a great many of the Daughters, and we just said, you know, when you see so many things happen in various situations, you say, oh, it's time to quit. Just forget it. That thing has served its purpose. It won't sit side by side with the other movements that are going on in its present form. And if it doesn't exist in its present form, it probably doesn't need to exist at all because there are other things that will take over and do whatever they're supposed to do.
Okay, now, one thing that I want to try and get clear, though, is the way in which the differences that you described, exactly the form they took. Because when you formally took over editorship, in, I guess, from Giddings in 66, you did make the statement in the Ladder that the Ladder was now going to concern itself more with women's issues, and that the Daughters had decided that women's concerns were primary.
Yes.
Now, how does that differ, though, from the position that, say, Barbara Greer and Rita LaPorte were taking?
Well, they didn't concern themselves very much with women's issues. I had the feeling that their issue was to kill the men. I think they should have joined, Scum or something
Scum,
like that. I think
right. They
would have been better off in that group.
So that instead of being, like, pro-women, they were primarily anti-male? Whereas
that was my feeling. See, my idea of being pro-woman was that we were going to seek out more other than just lesbian things. That we were going to look at a lot of things that perhaps other women's organizations later became very prominent in, and that was to deal more in our stories with great successes of women, whether they were gay or not. Well, I didn't get too much cooperation on that from Barbara, who was Barbara Greer, who was feeding me a good bit of the editorial material. I really had to go look for it myself. Dell and Phil found quite a bit. But it became very clear that she was seeking that type of writing and that type of material that would be really derogatory about men in general. And I know we had one author, I think her name is Jane Rule, who wrote very well.
Well, she's a wonderful novelist.
And she wrote one story.
She
sent me this story, and I printed it, and I had an absolutely scathing thing from Barbara Greer, because it was a story about a man and his wife, and someone in their family that was gay or something like that. And it was a very sympathetic, beautiful story about how they...
having to go to war.
It was a beautiful story. And I thought it was one of the best things we ever published. Well, Barbara said, we don't need that sort of thing in our magazine. Let some Woman's Home Journal or something print that. And she just went in fits. And I thought, well, I can see where her mind is. You know, we're just not going to make it. Because I was deeply impressed with almost everything Jane Rule sent me. I was always very pleased to get some of her stuff.
The convention, this is dealing with this later period. Now, the convention in Denver in 1968, can you describe what happened there and what the issues were and what the different sides were on positions?
Okay. It wasn't a convention. It was a meeting of the officers and advisors of the Daughters and people who did things like editors and stuff like that. And Shirley Willer had made this entire reorganization program, which, while we dearly love Shirley and Marion, that powerhouse steamroller comes in there with money, A, and B, a bunch of position papers and practically a whole new constitution, and she was just simply going to do this whole thing over.
Why was she trying to do that?
Oh, it was a dream she had of, she still got it, poor old bag. She honestly believed that with enough money and enough push and power and everything that you could take the Daughters and just make it a big force in the country and have a great big magazine and just do great big everything. And that you could have legal funds by which you could take on tremendous cases to the courts and so on. And I told her at the beginning that I couldn't support it, even though we were good friends and I loved her, but I couldn't do it.
Why were you against it?
Mainly because we didn't have enough of the kind of leadership and dedication to back up that kind of program. It would have evolved into her hands pretty rapidly. I don't think she'd have had much help. I was in no position to put out any more of a magazine than I was putting out right then. Several of our leaders had already begun to get kind of itchy about getting on into other organizations, women's organizations. I felt that she would just about be alone. And as it turned out, when we voted, she was. The group voted not to adopt the new constitution bylaws. They voted not to do any of these things. And continuously were for the time being, but then the time being didn't last very long because this other faction of Rita LaPorte and Barbara Greer had their ideas of what they wanted to do with it, and they took it.
How is it that Rita LaPorte was elected president at that meeting, since she seemed to be at odds with the long-standing philosophy of the Daughters?
Well, to tell you honestly, it was a power play to keep Shirley from being president, wasn't it? In Denver?
In Denver in 68.
Yeah. We had two people, one from Philadelphia, that we really would like to have had for president, but she felt that her job was too insecure and a lot of reasons that she had. She was also going to graduate school starting that next fall. There were a number of things involved that she simply refused to do it. Dell and Phil had other fish to fry. They weren't interested in it again for the 100th time. I certainly couldn't do it. We were scared to death that if Shirley got it, she would kill off everything, including herself, because we had very little choice. As a matter of fact, I don't think we had anybody running against her, did we? People just said no, and they didn't want it.
So she was elected president not so much because everybody thought she would be the best
president. Oh, no. It was to that extent a vacuum, and she also is an expert at Robert's Rules and a few things, and she can conduct a meeting. Yeah. And
said to Del Phil, you didn't tell us that. They said, well, we didn't know that. You know, it was a Jesus. We were voting for the best out of nothing, you know, and if we'd known that, we wouldn't have voted for him. They said, well, we didn't know
we had met her in San Francisco, and she'd visited with us from time to time.
She was a sincere person?
She was, but the poor gal had some problems. And we learned more about them later. And apparently Barbara Greer sensed that here was her power play, and as soon as Rita LaPorte was president, Barbara just took her and off they went.
Well, Rita tried to get rid of Barbara Greer, and that didn't work, because we can't live without a mentor, but I have a mentor. So then Jean Damon comes back, so she plied her all kinds of things. So this is something about someone who's purely autocratic, like Jean Damon, doesn't believe in democracy at all, whereas Rita LaPorte did. That's what she believed in up here, you know. But, you know, that's not where the action came. And, man, we just watched old Sandy, unfortunately, I think, burned by all this stuff.
Yes, I did.
Man, when we were... That's historical.
I wish you had saved it. Oh, God.
Well, you could have made fire on asbestos with this stuff.
I got a letter from her, and sometimes two, special delivery airmail letters every day for about 4 years. I was so sick of that when we moved from our home in Manhattan Beach, I cleaned that stuff up. Oh, the hell with it.
You said Barbara.
Yeah.
Not Giddings.
No, Giddings and I got along all right. And when the time came that we thoroughly understood that there was a difference of opinion as to what we were doing out here and what they wanted to do back east, there was no problem really. No big fight about switching editor or anything like that. And
Giddings was very honorable.
Yes.
Right. So that with Giddings, I mean, it was a legitimate, open difference.
Absolutely.
That people could live with.
That's right. I could sit down here today and have a marvelous time with Barbara Giddings. We never had a big fight.